Welcome to the DMD edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the Duchenne muscular dystrophy community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor, currently at the MDA's 2022 Clinical and Scientific Conference in Nashville, Tennessee. We're here today with Dr. Jerry Mendell, Curran Peters Research Chair and Professor of Neurology and Pediatrics at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. Dr. Mendell is among the most prominent experts in Duchenne muscular dystrophy and a pioneer in gene therapy. He met his first Duchenne patient in 1969 when he was at NIH. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Mendell, why is Duchenne muscular dystrophy your passion?
They were part of what you just said. In 1969, I met my first patient, and through the years, we have had virtually no satisfactory treatment for the disease. We started out with the first medication that made a difference and reported the results in 1987 for the use of prednisone in the disease that made a difference but wasn't satisfactory enough for those of us who really feel that we need to make a difference for this disease.
And over the course of the years, how many Duchenne patients would you say you've treated?
I mean, we have done many, many clinical trials. Most of them, unfortunately, didn't make a big difference. The ones that did make a difference were related to corticosteroids, but we tried myoblast transfer. That didn't work. We tried follistatin or myostatin inhibition, and that didn't work well. We tried, I guess, even medications like gentamicin to upregulate dystrophin production, and that didn't work. So we've been through a lot of courses in the treatment, and now we're finally making a difference we can see in our gene therapy studies.
So dystrophin, of course, is huge in size. Why is DMD so difficult to treat?
I think you framed it. We have to compromise the natural gene when we transfer that to patients who have a dysfunctional gene. So we have to cut the gene down to one-third of its size so that we can deliver it in a virus called adeno-associated virus, or AAV. And at Children's Hospital in Columbus, we use a subtype of AAV called RH74. And it just so happens that RH74 is derived from non-human primates. The reason that's important is because it's less likely that there is previous exposure to this virus and more tolerance from the patient point of view.
What about the side effects of prednisone and efforts to find steroids that actually work and don't have such detrimental effects on boys who are on it?
Well, we haven't been involved in those studies. What I've seen is that it can be effective, but when you get up to high doses that are comparable to what we use in standard dosing, which is we established back in the early days of prednisone administration at 0.75 milligrams per kilogram, or deflazacort, also called Emflaza, at 0.9 milligrams per kilogram, we don't get any fewer side effects with alternative approaches.
Could you tell us, if you will, about the journey you've taken to get to where we are today with gene therapy?
Well, my journey started at NIH, and that's a long time ago. And at NIH, we really had no idea the pathogenesis of the disease until Lou Kunkel identified the gene and reported the results in 1987. That was the marker that we can show progression from. Once Lou Kunkel identified the gene, then we had a molecular basis for treatment, molecular referring to altering the gene in some way. And we've tried multiple ways, and the most effective way has been to put the gene into adeno-associated virus and transfer it to patients. But what we also learned, I did my first trial for gene therapy in 1999. It was not in Duchenne. It was in limb-girdle muscular dystrophy. The reason we chose that as a starting point for gene therapy is because we could deliver the entire gene. And that means it was less than what we call 5,000 base pairs or 5,000 kilobases. The number's not important, but what is important is that, for example, limb-girdle muscular dystrophy genes are about half that size. We can deliver that much easier than we can the Duchenne gene, which we're talking about three times the size of what AAV virus will hold. So that was the starting point. Lou Kunkel started it, And we moved on from that in multiple ways to try to deliver the gene in as high a doses and as efficiently as possible. And in terms of efficiency, also, it's important that when we did our first trials, we could not produce enough virus to inject intravenously or systemically. We started in a systematic manner. We started first injecting the gene in a local manner to show the FDA that we could do safe trials and have local efficacy. So if we injected it into the biceps or leg muscle, we could show that the gene expressed. From that point, we went to regional vascular delivery, where we injected the gene into the lower extremities. And we had some favorable results, but we needed enough production facilities to the entire body musculature. And we're talking about the entire muscle composition of the body is maybe around 60% of your body weight. So how do we deliver the gene to that large a quantity of target? We had to make a lot of virus. And what made the difference was when we started using very high doses, very cautiously, and we did this in a stepwise manner, and then we started with very high dosing as we use now, that makes it possible to actually make a difference for the disease.
That's quite an explanation. What is it you're working on right now? What is your focus?
We're in our fourth Duchenne muscular dystrophy trial. We started in 2014, the first patient on January 4th in 2014, and I'll never forget that. We did four patients in a pilot trial. It was highly successful, and those boys are now in their fourth year, and they are still showing efficacy without much change in how they've improved. And they've improved very significantly with very high levels of dystrophin expression, or I correct myself, we have to call it microdystrophin now, because it's one third of the size of full dystrophin. Then we went on to what we call a phase two trial, where we did a double-blind randomized control trial. That's very hard on patients and actually hard on us as investigators, because we're blinded for the full study. That study, we have now completed 2 years of that study, and we're in the third year of that study. Now, because of the success of those two trials, we've moved on to what we call a phase three trial. Phase three trial is what the FDA accepts as potentially leading to gene approval. And phase three trial is what we've started with a very, I would say, goals that are unequivocal in terms of showing efficacy. We have, the plan is, and I've worked closely with Sarepta Pharmaceuticals on this, and we have targeted 120 patients for inclusion. That's a very large number. And we have 40 sites that we brought into this trial. And at the completion of this trial, we hope to have approval for gene therapy. Approval opens up many doors for gene therapy for Duchenne patients.
Well, that would be a landmark to get FDA approval for the first time ever of a gene therapy for Duchenne. And we've, of course, seen what's happened with SMA. So you're hopeful that at some point soon, you can replicate the success that SMA has had with Duchenne as well.
Exactly. And when we got approval for SMA, of course, it was a very thankful day. But what happened after that was, as soon as we had approval from FDA, we had newborn screening. Newborn screening then led to being able to treat patients in their early infancy before the disease took hold. And then we were able to really change the natural history and essentially lead to almost normal kids that would have been predicted to die at 2 years of age. So that has all changed. The same path will be followed in our Duchenne trial. If we get approval, that will bring newborn screening into the picture. When we bring newborn screening into the picture, that means that we can start treating patients within the first few weeks of life. And that's before the disease takes hold. And then we have a whole new picture in the Duchenne field. And that will be a very gratifying experience for people like me who've been in this for how many years. I don't even know anymore.
You mentioned that in 2010, you conducted the nation's first newborn screening program for Duchenne. What were the results, and why has that not been replicated on a national scale?
I think it's been recognized on a national scale. And if you look, you'll see that what we showed in that trial was that the Duchenne incidence at birth was 1 in 5,000. You see that now that most publications now that refer to incidence refer to our trial at 1 to 5,000. What we did that was unique in that trial was with a DNA blood spot taken for various numbers of diseases in various states. In Ohio, we have about 35 diseases that are diagnosed at birth or that are tested at birth for diagnosis. And on that dried blood spot, there were no other even dried blood spots needed. We took the ones that were taken. And from that dried blood spot, we were able to determine the CK, which is the biomarker for the disease. And we took DNA from the dried blood spot. The advantage of that was we took that at birth and we didn't have to go back to the patient or back to the family. We could do the full spectrum of diagnosis from the dried blood spot and make a definitive diagnosis. And that's what we did. That's what was unique and novel about that study. Most of the ones since that time have been just obtaining the CK level and then going back to the patient. So some of the patients would not be available. Some of the patients would not want to know, you know, what their results were. They would contribute maybe to the research, but not to their own knowledge, because most patients with Duchenne are diagnosed at 4 to 5 years old and sometimes later. And that diagnosis delays treatment. If we can do the newborn, we are going to have unmatched results for the disease,
but still,
make a difference.
It's up to individual states to add diseases to their panel.
Absolutely.
So Ohio seems to be a leader in this, but what about getting all states on board?
I don't think that'll be a problem. I think that'll be recognized at a national level and recommended through to all the states. Some will be resistant, as they are for COVID vaccinations and everything else. That's the beauty of living in America. They have their right. But most of them will approve of the newborn screening for Duchenne dystrophy. And if they don't, patients would have potential access to that through other means for diagnosis. Once they find that this is available, you'll see more and more people doing it.
Dr. Mendell, thank you so much for speaking with us. Much appreciated.
You're welcome.
This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor. Thanks for listening.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.